Hare Krishna, Mirabai. Good to see you.
Oh my gosh, just when I thought I'd technology. How are you?
I'm fine. I've been waiting for the last couple of days to be with you and all of your esteemed guests on this program. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for taking the time. My gosh, I feel very blessed to have you on here and talk to us and shed some light.
Thank you.
Yeah. So before we kind of go into Dasya, I was just wondering if maybe you could share with us a little bit about your journey and how you kind of came to Krishna consciousness.
You and I were discussing that a little bit yesterday. And I was thinking this morning, actually, it's interesting because in the Vedic culture, the life of sadhus, you actually never ask a sadhu what they did before they were a sadhu. Because, you know, that's a different life. And they, you could say they turn their back on their past to move forward. I think there's that saying that every sinner has a past and every saint has a future. So, but still, I would like to share with you, maybe it will give some inspiration to others. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I'm very happy that our spiritual paths crossed in the auspicious Dham of Rishikesh, and we were able to sit together and discuss spiritual topics. I'd also like to offer my respects to your Guru Bhai, your spiritual teacher, Govinda Das. I actually met him. I don't know if he's watching, but I met him many, many years ago in California. I was invited to one of his programs, and we had a big kirtan. We were dancing like crazy. So we became friends on that transcendental platform. So I offer him my respects. As far as myself, this body, which I'm not, the soul and the body, but the body, I was born in San Francisco, California, many years ago, 71 years ago. And are we still on? Because it's circling, you know. Yeah. Are we still there? I can still speak. Yeah. And just to speed it up, I don't want to take too much time talking about myself. I guess many of us, you know. Anyway, to make a long story short, because I am 71, and if I cover that whole period, it would take up many hours of your program. But I guess you could say my eyes started to open in the 60s. You know, in America, we had that counterculture movement amongst the young people. And that was right in the middle of my high school days, from 64 to 1967. That was the age of the flower power. And, you know, my generation was questioning the norms of society, and we were involved in the civil rights movement in the South, anti-war demonstrations. You know, the hippie movement was flourishing, so we were all either being hippies or trying to be hippies and so forth and so on. So I was very much influenced by that. And I don't want to go into too much details for my disciples, what I was doing in those days. But I eventually became disillusioned with it because it really wasn't going anywhere. I think the philosophy was stay high forever. But whatever you did to get high, you came back down again. And for me, that wasn't a very exhilarating experience. So I gave up my bell-bottom pants and my flowers and my beads, and I exchanged them for a rifle. Which, like, what? Usually you do the other way. You give up your rifle to become a beatnik or a hippie, you know. Make love, not war. But I was searching for something, and my father was a military man. So along with practically my entire high school football team, we decided to do the patriotic thing, and we joined America's elite best fighting force, Semper Fi. We joined the Marine Corps right in the middle of the Vietnam War. And, you know, we went to boot camp, and then when my unit was sent overseas to fight in Vietnam, my superiors kept me back for a month because they wanted me to do advanced infantry training to become a sniper, a killer. I was a lover, then I became a killer. And while I was in training, one day, my unit, they were going through the jungle, and they were attacked by the Viet Cong. And every single member of my football team died. The quarterback, the center, the right end, the left guard, the right guard. And these are boys that I grew up with since I was 5 years old. We used to catch frogs in the pond and run through the fields and, you know, this and everything. So that for me was a was my first, you could say, experience of material life. Krishna defines the in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Punar Arvitu Arjuna Mamopetiti Kuntia Punar Janma Nividyate. That from the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest, all the places of repeated birth and death and a great struggle for existence. So that was my first slap in the face, because I came from a good family and never had to struggle. And I was on base at Camp Pendleton in San Diego, and I lost it. I told them, I mean, I was training to be a good warrior, a good fighter, a good killer. But everything changed when I lost one of my friends. I never really questioned life at that time. I never, you know, like the sadhus say that human life begins not when you're born from the womb of your mother, because animals also get born from the womb of their mother. Human life begins when you start questioning, who am I, where have I come from, what happens at the moment of death, does God exist? That means you're taking proper advantage of the human form of life. So that spiritual birth is more significant than your material birth. So that's what it did to me. I had that post-traumatic stress symptom back in 1968, 69, before they even had that term. I was so much disturbed by it all that the Marine Corps let me go. They gave me an honorable discharge, but I was just like, where do my friends go? Why does this happen if there's God? You know. So it was a mixed blessing, because then I began my spiritual search, and I went to live in a Buddhist monastery for about 6 or 7 months, shaved my head, put on the you know, the burgundy clothes of the monks, and studied there. Then I went to Europe, and I ended up in the Middle East. I studied Islam, stayed in a mosque. Then I went to Jerusalem. I studied Judaism. I studied Christianity. Anything spiritual I could get my hands on, any books I could read, like a man dying of thirst, I just drank that knowledge as best I could. But with all due respect, something was missing. I couldn't find the answers to all of my questions. So eventually I ended up back in America, and I got a job at a university in Michigan as a gardener. And it's funny how the Lord works, because they say the ways of the Lord are mysterious. You know, I'd been in all these spiritual places, monasteries and mosques and churches and synagogues. But where did I find my calling? On the campus lawn of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I was raking the leaves, and I looked to my left, and there were these tall monks with shaved heads and ponytails singing a song I'd never heard before. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. It was all new to me. So I went up to them and I said, you know, what, are you guys from India? You look like Americans. This is the beginning of the movement. 1969, I think it was. And they explained to me that they were representing their spiritual masters, Srila Prabhupada, and so forth and so on. So I invited them to stay with me in my apartment. They stayed with me for 3 weeks, and that was the end of my material existence and the beginning of my spiritual existence. That was 1969. I took initiation from my spiritual master in 1970. He gave me an instruction to preach boldly and always have faith in the holy names of God, Krishna, or Ram, as you like. And I took sannyas, which means the renounced order of life, in 1979. And from then on, I've been traveling. There's an injunction in Vedic culture that a sannyasi should not stay in one place more than 3 days. So I follow that very strictly. Why? Because a rolling stone gathers no moss. And in order to become spiritually enlightened, two things are required. Number one, you have to give up your material attachments. And number two, you have to embrace your spiritual desires, which are essentially to love God. It's a twofold path. So in order to do that, you have to practice some discipline. The word disciple comes from the word discipline, which meant when I took initiation and took my vows, I promised no more meat, fish, or eggs. I've been vegetarian since I was 14, but no intoxication, no sex outside of marriage, and no gambling. And that's a big challenge for most people because our lives kind of revolve around those are the ways we find pleasure, we find our relaxation. But to transcend this world, the sadhus say those are the roots of material existence. Like a tree is standing tall, but the roots of the tree go deep into the ground and keep it stable. So the foundation for spiritual life is some very strict discipline. I embrace that, and I was able to do it. As Chanakya Panda says in the Niti Shastra, you can only give up something if you get something better. So it was a challenge to give up my American, I was a football star, I was an athlete, played guitar, I was in a rock band, you know, I was a Marine Corps corporal, I had so much to be proud of, but that wasn't really me, because that all had to do with my body. Who am I? Jivasupoya Krishnara Nitya Das. I am the soul within the body, and the nature of that soul is that he's a dasya, he's a servant of Krishna. So I was able to renounce it because I found so much inner pleasure in my spiritual activities. So that's my journey. That's part of my journey. And my spiritual master asked me to keep traveling, so I've kind of always been an adventuresome person. So I went to Russia, and when it was 1988, it was still full-on communism. I went there to share the teachings of Bhagavad Gita with the people, full on communism. I had to go in with a wig. I had a fake mustache. I put on a business suit. And I had a briefcase full of Jack Daniel's whiskey. Now, wait a minute, you said you're a monk, you're a sannyasi, so what are you, you know, you gave up intoxication, so what are you carrying a briefcase of whiskey? Because you weren't allowed to teach religion in communist Russia. So I figured if they caught me with the whiskey, they would say, you know, he's not a priest. He's carrying whiskey. I kept a half bottle, and I didn't fill the whole thing. So it was my ploy. So I traveled the length and breadth of Russia during the communist time. So many adventures. KGB found out about me. Several times I had to jump out of the first or second story of apartments into the snow and run into the forest and hide, you know, tunnel myself under the snow like they taught us in the Marine Corps if we were in that situation, hide, you know, hide up in the trees so that he wouldn't catch me. So then I went to China, which was also communist. I also had to be incognito there. But I always met people who were interested because there are people who are, you could say, disillusioned with material life like I was. They're searching for the answers of life. And I think it's the Lord's arrangement that if you have that desire, the Lord will accommodate it by leading you to a spiritual organization, spiritually minded people who you can live with and grow spiritually. I also went, well, I went many places. I went to Tibet. I went to Mongolia. I went to Brazil. I went to the Amazon jungle.
And this was all in the early days of ISKCON.
Up till about 1989, we're going, 1990. In the Amazon jungle, I was very naive, you know, a jungle. I've read Jungle Book, you know, Rudyard Kipling, the Jungle Book, the monkeys, and you can ride the elephants, and you can even scratch the tigers. The Amazon jungle wasn't like that. It was a wild...
You were, like,
dangerous place. I was gifted a big boat by the governor of the Amazon. I took 7 devotees with me. We went up the Amazon River all the way to, I think it was Venezuela. So many adventures. I was swimming one day and the piranha fish started coming in a group across the river. I had to swim, get back on the boat. I fell into quicksand. The devotees had to pull me out of the quicksand. There were alligators there. I got very, very sick. I went to a witch doctor. He gave me a special potion, which cured me. One day we can do an interview about that. It's a 3-hour talk, Amazon. But like this, whatever your tendency is in bhakti, you dovetail it. You don't have to become a different person. You can be who you are. You give up your bad habits. And whatever nature God has endowed you with, if you're a businessman, if you're an artist, if you're a musician, if you're a painter, whatever you do, you, instead of using that for yourself, you use it to glorify God. And that's the actual meaning of bhakti, love. You know, a lover likes to talk more about their beloved than themselves. So if you love God, you want to serve God. When you love someone, you want to do some seva for them. You know, you have a wife, you have children, you have friends. The natural inclination is, I have a loving relationship with you. Let me do something for you. This is how you have to express your bhakti, express your devotion. So being of that adventuresome spirit, I have traveled the whole world. I've pretty much been everywhere and seen everything. And it's reinforced my conviction that, you know, this material world is not a very nice place. It's not our home. And I want to go home, back to the spiritual world, which is described by the saints as eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. So I've stuck to the path for 50 years now. And I haven't been tempted to go back. One time my spiritual master said to us, never look back and think you've left anything behind. And never envy the position of those who appear to be enjoying this world. There's some enjoyment in this world. But it's like a drop of water in the tongue of a thirsty man. It's not enough to satisfy you. Real happiness comes from within. So through bhakti, through service to my guru and to Krishna, I've remained fixed on the path by their grace alone. And I'm very happy. I have to admit, I'm very happy. No regrets.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, it's so inspirational, you know, to hear, you know, everything, and I'm sure there's way more, but everything you faced in serving Krishna and sharing Krishna and sharing Gita, it's amazing. Yeah.
It's natural. It's something natural. Because, you know, if you look within and you find yourself, it'll confirm what's there in the ancient texts of India. Trivera Supoya Krishnara Nitya Das. We're all spirit souls. And what is the nature of that soul? The soul's a servant. God is great and we're very small, so we have a subservient attitude. Sometimes certain transcendentalists want to become God, but there's no question of becoming God. God is always God. And we're always a tiny servant. If we were God, then why do we find ourselves an illusion? God never comes overpowered by the material energy. So we're servants, and sometimes the people hear the philosophy we should serve the divine, we should serve the absolute, we should serve God, we should serve Krishna. Look, I don't know, because you know, in this world, servants are often taken advantage of. We serve our boss, he doesn't give us a raise. We serve our country, they take our taxes. We serve a friend, they don't reciprocate the gift. You know, sometimes service, we kind of like, I don't want to serve.
Give you the word servant.
Yeah, like servant. I don't want to be the slave. But if you're the servant of a glorious master, it's a whole different experience. If you're the servant of a very benevolent, loving, caring master like Lord Ram, then you see why Hanuman is so satisfied. Hanuman is 100% satisfied just being the Dasya servant. There's other service relationships you can have with God, with Krishna. You can become the friend of Krishna. He'll allow you to be. You can be the friend of God, have a friendly relationship, equals, quote unquote. You can have a parental mood. You want to take care of Krishna as your little child, like Mother Yashoda or Nanda Maharaj. You can have a relationship with Krishna like the cowherd girls of Vrindavan. They're gopis. They have a very intimate, loving relationship with Krishna. All of them are perfect and complete. And no one servant is thinking that he's better than the other. He appreciates the service of others. So you might think, oh, Hanuman, he's just a little servant of Ram, but the gopis and the cowherd boys in Vrindavan, they get to hug Krishna and wrestle with Krishna. But no, variety is the spice of life. So within everyone's heart, there's already bhakti. There's already you already have a relationship with Krishna. It's not something that you pick and choose. Oh, I think I'd like to be this, I'd like to be that. It's already there. It's eternally established. But you have to awaken it. And the awakening process is what you were mentioning the other day, the ninefold process of Krishna consciousness. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Bandham, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam. Hearing about Krishna, chanting Krishna's holy names, remembering Krishna, serving the lotus feet, worshipping the deity, praying, bandhanam, serving, making friendships, surrendering everything. These are the ways that you, like the lotus flowers closed in the nighttime, but in the morning when the sun comes, the lotus flower opens. And by high noon, you can see the full beauty of the lotus flower. So right now, our real beauty is closed. We're just into this body and everything we can satisfy with this body. You don't really see the beauty of the soul. You can see it a little bit because the eyes, you can say the eyes are the, you can see the life of the soul through the eyes, the brilliance of the eyes.
The windows
to the soul. But the sages, they say that the soul is more brilliant than 10,000 suns rising simultaneously. So how to open that beautiful lotus flower? You chant, you hear, you serve, you pray, you make friendship with devotees, and then gradually that lotus flower of love, of bhakti, it begins to open. So on the one hand, you practice discipline, you don't engage in the activities that keep you connected to this world. On the other hand, you do the positive activities like dasam. You serve. And how do we serve? Many examples in society of people are serving their boss very nicely, they're serving their friends very nicely, they're serving their country. Sometimes people even sacrifice their lives. But that's not the bhakti we're talking about, not that type of service. It's Eke Kudanandan, it's that service which is focused on your worshipable deity. You might be attracted to Hanuman, you might be attracted to Ram, you might be attracted to Krishna, you might be attracted to Nrisingadev. So you hear about them constantly, you sing their glories, you offer your food to them before eating it, you associate with devotees who also have that inclination, and then that dasyam, that service attitude, becomes more and more and more mature, so that at the moment when you die, because you've been serving your Ishtadev for so long, that strong desire for that connection, it takes you to that planet in the spiritual world where your Ishtadev is. So that's dasyam. That's bhakti.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a big part of having this Dasya Bhava, this outlook of servitude is, I think, you know, if we are in total surrender to our Lord, and we can see everything and everyone as a creation of the Lord, then we can serve everything.
You can.
Not our deity, not just our puja table or our God that we believe in, but we see everything as a manifestation or a creation of our Lord, that we can serve each other.
That's a good observation. It's actually there in the Gita. Krishna said, Vidya Vinaya Sampane, Brahmani Gavi Hastani, Sunichaiva Sapakicha, Pandita Samadarshana. Darshana means to see. Pandit means a spiritually enlightened person. He sees with equal vision an elephant, a cow, a brahmana, a dog, and a dog eater. They're all situated in different bodies because of their past activities, their karma. But a spiritual person doesn't see the body. He sees the soul. So if you become God conscious, you'll see everything. You'll see every living entity as a part and parcel of God, and you will associate with them accordingly. You won't take your friend out to a disco because you know their spirit soul. You won't take them out for a drink, but you'll invite them into your home for bhajan. You won't take your boss on a vacation to Trinidad or someplace to enjoy the world. You'll take your boss to your local shrine or your temple or some Rishikesh or some place, holy place in India. That's the relationship that you'll have with the person once you become God realized. You'll see them all as godly, part and parcel of God, and with them you'll have that deep spiritual relationship.
Maybe I can ask you a question on this topic.
I saw a bumper sticker in America. It said, real friends don't let their friends eat meat. So, you know, friendship in the material world, let's dance, let's drink, let's smoke a joint, there's a type of humor, a type of friendship in that, but those are quote-unquote material activities by which we accumulate karma and become more entangled in the web of material existence. But if with real friendship, real parenthood, real love between lovers means to do things on the spiritual platform so that you elevate each other back to the spiritual abode.
Yeah, doesn't really get us anywhere. I mean, we may enjoy it for the time being, but in terms of the bigger picture, it really doesn't.
Even if you have the slightest attachment to this world, you have to come back. That's how strict the rules are. Yam yam vapi smaram bhavam tiyajiti anta kalevaram. Krishna says in the Gita, when you leave this world, whatever you think about at the moment of death, that state you will attain. So if you have some attachment, you know, there was that guy in your life, that girl, you know, you're a yogi, right? And you've really made advancement. You've been living in Rishikesh, Badrinath, or, you know, you're a scholar, you know the Vedas, or you're a devotee of Krishna, you know, whatever. But if you maintain that attachment, then you have to come back to the school of hard knocks until you give up every attachment in this world. It's you know, we all want to go home, but you have to get the visa to go there, and that means getting rid of all your attachments, but you can replace them. You can replace the food of this world with prasadam, which means the food offered to the deity. Instead of listening to, you know, to D-Nice every night as he does, you know, his DJ thing on the, you know, he's very popular, D-Nice. You listen to, you know, your favorite band in the 60s, the Stones. Instead of doing that, you listen to kirtan. Instead of, you know, working just to maintain your livelihood, you donate some of your money to the establishment of a ashram or feeding the sadhus or something, you know. So we have to replace our material attachments by awakening our spiritual attachments. So Vasudeva Sarvamiti takes many lifetimes, actually. Many lifetimes.
And you know, you mentioned something to me too when you were in Rishikesh, and I said to you, you know, I'm not perfect. I do X, Y, and Z. And you said, yeah, it's okay. Slowly those things will fall off. Now that I think about it, without trying, a lot of those things have come. And then I just realized now I'm on the I think in the last 3 years, I've not listened to anything other than my Hear Them playlist that I have on Spotify. And I mean, I know all kinds of music. I have a giant record collection. I grew up on hip hop. It's just interesting. I just realized that not all that music just fell off with stuff on it.
Well, we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't feel guilty if we maintain those attachments because, you know, everyone has their own pace. And if we think ill of someone, oh, they're so attached, you know, we can only understand that attachment because it's still in our heart. Like when you point a finger at someone, you're pointing three fingers at yourself, you know. So we tend to be hard on others and easy on ourselves. Whereas we should be hard on ourselves and easier on others. But we should know that if we're following a bona fide spiritual path, we'll relinquish those attachments easily. Because, again, you can only give up something if you get something better. So if your mantra, or your asanas, or your study of the scriptures, or your bathing in holy rivers like the Ganga, the Saraswati, if you're actually doing that in sincerity, you'll get more pleasure from that than those things that have kept you bound up in material existence life after life after life. And bear in mind, Brahmanda Brahmati Konya Bhagavan Jeev, we've been traveling through material existence for millions and millions and millions of lives. That's the statement of scripture. This isn't our first life. We've been there and done that. We've been in every species of life. We've been a king, we've been a queen, we've been a pauper, we've been a fool, we've been literate, we've been a prisoner, we've been the president, we've done it all. And in this life, or in a few previous lives, we woke up. Somehow, we came to our senses, we saw the light, and we're taken to the spiritual path. And we're not home yet, because we still have some attachments. So the idea is to just, you know, life is short and then you die. We have to make this our priority. Not that, you know, I have my business, I have my family, I have my school. Those things are important, but our heartbeat, boom, 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 that's our sadhana. That's our goal in life, to become free from the cycle of reincarnation, to go back to the spiritual world, to awaken my love for my Ishtadeva, for God. So as you get older, you begin to realize that, because you see the clocks ticking. Like they have that hourglass, you turn it upside down, the sands. So like, what am I going to do now? I've only got so much time left, I'm not fully satisfied. I've tried my best to enjoy this world. So then, generally we see people really become serious about spiritual life in old age. Like, you know, people renounce their work in India and they go to the Himalayas at around 50. They may have been big people in business, big people in politics. They walk away from it and they sit with the sadhus in Rishikesh or Dave Pryor. You wouldn't know that they were a Supreme Court justice. You wouldn't know they were big businessman. They know that human life is meant for self-realization, so they did their dharma to their family, their country, and they give it their all for spiritual life. But if you can have that mentality when you're young, you've got a really good chance, you know, of getting there. Which was so wonderful about Rishikesh, because we, in our kirtans, remember, so many people were coming from all over the world and they were singing and dancing the mantras so nicely. I was thinking, wow, this is great. These people are really getting fixed on the spiritual path. There's a chance in this lifetime they could achieve mukti, liberation.
Thoughts? You know, you were speaking of Vedic culture, the four ashramas of life, or the four stages of life. And yeah, generally it's seen that when you're older, it's when you kind of renounce everything and you go live in an ashram and you kind of focus more on spiritual things. And it's really interesting because you do places like this, you see a lot of younger people kind of doing these things that traditionally Indians would think that is more later in life. It's funny because I mentioned earlier I have quite a few Indian friends here, and they don't know what we hear that. You know, I'm 32, they're around, you know, late 20s, early 30s. And they just think it's the funniest thing that I've been to kirtan and that I do puja and all this stuff. They're like, my mom does that, or that's what my grandpa does. Or like, my grandpa says that she needs some you know.
I know what you're talking about.
They call me Mataji when I walk in the room, you know. It's like to that level. And, yeah, it's just interesting how...
There was a book, I forget who wrote it, in South Africa. It was called Cry, My Beloved Country. And it was talking about how South Africa was in the old days, you know, when it was a smaller country with less population, mainly African people. But then, you know, many people came to work in the country, became citizens, etc. And then, you know, all the politics and the crime and the envy and the hatred came about. So that book was called Cry, My Beloved Country. You know, where did our country go? So when I think about India, I think like that also. Because I first came here in 1970. And Vrindavan, which is one of the most holy places in India where Krishna appeared, it was just a dusty little village. And there was some cows. There was one car in the whole village. Mainly just sadhus. There was no business people. You know, it was just the holy river Jamuna and 5,000 temples. It was so beautiful, so touching to the heart. And now it's become famous, and that's good in one sense, but a conglomerate of, looks like New Hong Kong. There's so many big buildings, taxis, horns, pollution, etc. So there was another book written by a famous author, Basham. He said, the glory that was India. So India's kind of lost it. The young generation's lost it. They're all going to Silicon Valley to become IT technicians. But the Westerners are coming from California to India. It's this irony, you know. They're going to the West for material progress, and the Westerners are becoming a little bit disillusioned. I mean, material progress is good. We're speaking with, you know, on the internet. I have nothing against it if it's not misused. But they're coming to India, so, you know, it's a funny point in history. And yeah, India is kind of forgotten, but still the sadhus are there. The sadhus are the saving grace of this country.
Yeah. And you do, you have the West looking East for inspiration.
Yeah.
And you have the East looking West. And
yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, we're one big family. So as long as Sanatana Dharma is surviving with whoever, great.
East is East and West is West, never the twain shall meet. But they have met, you know, in the skies over the Atlantic. All the young men, ladies going to America, and all the Westerners coming to India, they meet there. But it's a sharing of cultures. I mean, it's much more a progressive country now. The people are, some people are getting better facilities, but I hope that they don't lose their original culture, because it's a very, very deep culture. And like Western countries are setting the pace for material evolution, India always has, will always have this, the beacon of spiritual knowledge for the rest of the world, because nothing compares to the Puranas, the Vedas, the Itihasas, you know. With all due respect to other traditions, spiritual traditions, if you make a comparative study with Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, perfect questions, perfect answers. It's all there. And I think that's like why many of us have embraced this way of life. You know, we've given up our Western way of life for this Eastern way of life, because of the philosophy and the culture that surrounds it, which enables us even to become spiritually enlightened, although we weren't born in this country.
Yeah. And like you said, you know, with all due respect to all other traditions, for me, and I'm sure for you as well, it's like, it just makes sense. You know, it just makes sense. And the scriptures and all the way information through Shruti came to the rishis and then was recorded down. It wasn't somebody, I don't want to get too into that, but it just makes sense, at least for me, you know, and I'm sure for you also. But I never studied much. I was really into other, I've always been into religion. So I've also, you know, looked into this and that and read about this and that, but it's when I really found Eastern philosophy, in particular Hinduism, that really, I think it just made sense, you know.
I see it like school, you know. I mean, I've chosen this path, this Hinduism path, But because I associated so much with Buddhists and Christians and Jewish people and Muslims, I can't forget the lessons I learned from them. They were stepping stones to my accepting this path. So I see it kind of like school. Like, you know, you go to grade school and you learn one plus one is two. Then you go to high school and you learn, you know, algebra and different aspects of mathematics. And then you go to university, it goes deeper, then you get a PhD. It's all the same subject matter. It's all mathematics, but there's different stages of learning that. And, you know, you can quit school at high school if you want. Don't learn any more math. But if you want, there's schools where you can go, and you can go higher and higher and higher. So I think that, you know, Krishna has arranged this world in such a way that as much as people want to advance spiritually, there's always something for everybody. And if they're taken to that path in sincerity, you can't criticize them, you can't speak out, oh, I'm better than you, you know, look at you, you're not as advanced as me. You should see that at one point, you know, you were also a beginner, intermediate, or advanced, you know, you may be at a particular stage, but it's all an evolution. And people should choose that spiritual path which they feel comfortable with, give it all their heart, and we'll meet in the supreme abode. But this Eastern path, it's so, there's so much philosophy to strengthen your faith, because we don't want to become sentimental, you know, in our faith. I just love this, and I love this. There has to be realized knowledge. So you have to have philosophy which strengthens your faith. And that's the thing about India. They used to call India Bharat. India is a new name. Bharat means the land of light, but not in the sense like it's a tropical country, but light in the sense of transcendental knowledge, which destroys the darkness of ignorance. So, you know, you and myself and your Guru Dave, Govinda Dave, and all of us, we've been attracted not only by the colors and the spices and the bright sunshine and the, you know, India is such an amazing place, but the philosophy and the discipline and the culture that's there. So you live in this country. You know, you stay, and I spend half a year here as well when I'm not traveling. We've kind of become the adopted sons and daughters of Vedic culture. If you ask me what country I'm from, I'll say I'm from Bharat. Where's my home? San Francisco? No. Vrindavan? Like that, right? We fully embraced it. We have a long way to go. But we're in the right place at the right time doing the right thing. And if people can't do that, then fine. But everybody should have some sadhana every day. Some yoga, some meditation, some study of the shastra. Everyone should have that in their lives.
Yeah. You know, I just wanted to mention something. You know, we were talking about different traditions and the different faiths. And one thing with my guru, Pearly Baba, is he dealt with a lot of the big influx of Westerners coming to him of all different faiths, grew up, you know, whether Jewish or Christian. Had a very special connection with Christ. And when the Westerners would ask, you know, how do you meditate? He'd say, you meditate with Christ. How did Christ meditate? He'd say, he lost himself in love. Or they'd ask, you know, how do we raise our kundalini or whatever, you know, and he'd tell people to meet people, and serve people, and you remember God. That's how you raise your you know, Govinda has mentioned this also in our session, is the improved ways to tell people, you know, going back to Dasya, is that Hanuman and Ram are the same. Both here to their Lord, their Father, you know, and I think it's important to remember that in every tradition you can learn something, you know. It may not be on that per se, but, you know, I feel like the universal message in most traditions comes back to love, to devotion, to bhakti, you know. And I know Hare Krishna spoke on our last session too, that it's natural for us, you know, it's what our heart wants to do. And one of my first quotes I ever heard from Raghunath Swami. I didn't know anything about anything. That's 11. His first book, Buddha said, quoted him, and said that, you know, the deepest desire of the soul is to give and receive love. And I'll never forget that quote, because it's what really got me thinking and starting to look into kind of what is Eastern philosophy, and what is this idea of love and bhakti, and who's this Ramaswamy guy? And it's interesting, we can kind of put a lot of things aside to see commonalities that a lot of these paths have, and really just come down to.
I think the beauty, I think the special contribution of India or Bharat or the ancient books or the sadhus past and present, I think the unique thing is that there's a very vivid, detailed description of God. That's what was missing for me in other traditions, you know, that the faith was there. You know, even Einstein said, after all my study of this creation, I've come to the conclusion there's an intelligent being behind it. That's what he said. So every tradition, they have a belief in a supreme being, but without detailed knowledge of that being, it's hard to awaken your love. You can't love someone you don't know. Like, for example, you know, you choose a husband because of the way he walks, the way he talks, the way he dresses, his humor. Do you like the same food? You know, it's the details like that. So the Vedic scriptures, they give a very detailed description of Krishna. What his form looks like, his spiritual form, Satchidananda Vigraha, the way he dresses, his charming, debonair nature, his kindness to his devotees, the environment he lives in Vrindavan, the peacocks and the doves and the parrots and the loving exchanges like this. So it's easy to fall in love with the Supreme, with the Divine, as a result of having a wealth, a treasure house of knowledge. And I think that this is really what India, the unique thing that India has to offer the world, is an explanation of who he is and what he does. He's just so amazing, you fall in love with him. And then you want to serve him. I think that's missing. I'm not criticizing, but I think that's it's like you're still in high school, you're not in college yet, you haven't got your PhD, but keep going. Go east, young man. You know, we say here in America, go west, young man. We go east because in India, it's all there, it's complete.
Yeah. You know, Swamiji, I never thought of that, and it's true. Like, in all these scriptures, it's whether it's Krishna, or even, you know, it's like, we get descriptive images of who they are, what they're like, their different pastimes. And I've never really made that connection, but yeah, we don't get a ton of that in other traditions, so therefore it is really, I can see how that would be harder to really cultivate a deeper sense of devotion.
It's the detail, just like, you know, you're Mirabai. So we started talking one day, and I appreciated you because I could see you're a sincere practitioner, you're humble, you don't claim to have given up all your attachments, you know, and you liked Shadam, and you were articulate, you know. I started thinking, this is a nice young lady. Or somebody said to me, you know, 2 years ago, do you know this girl, Mirabai? I said, I don't know. What do you think about her? An opinion? Do you like her? I don't know. Do you not like her? I don't know. But because I met you, and I met different people in Rishikesh, then relationships started. And as the relationships developed, you know, like in spiritual life, there's appreciation for God, then there's affection, and then there's love. So that's the beauty of this Vedic culture, that Krishna has incarnated here in his different forms, not once, but at least 10 times as the Das Avatars, the main Ishtadevas, you know. But there's a wealth of knowledge. So you study the Puranas, the Upanishads, the Gita, you're just taking a quantum leap in your spiritual evolution. It's so important. And when you sing the names of those deities, then you sing with bhakti. You sing with bhakti. You know, you can sing, you know, Jai Sri Ram, Raghupati Raghava Rajaram, Patita Pavana Sitaram. you don't know who they are, if you haven't read Ramayana, you just, the lips are moving, but if you've heard about them and you've tasted their food and associated with the devotee, then Raghupati Raghava Rajaram. You know what I mean? So the philosophy strengthens our bhakti, and that we have in India. You know, the Gita, 700 verses of the Gita, the 18,000 slokas of Bhagavatam, the 64,000 whatever it is slokas of Ramayana. So important. That's India's gift, you know. Therefore, we shouldn't think these are Indian books. These are universal teachings. They're not just meant for the people of India. Everyone's a spirit soul. So it's like George Harrison said, everyone's a devotee of Krishna. Some know it and some don't. He said that. He was a friend of our movement. So the books of India are actually meant for the whole world. This isn't an Indian culture. This is a culture coming from the spiritual world. Shanatan Dharma. So, you know, if we can encourage people to, you know, go forward in their study of the scriptures, and then they'll chant the mantras and the bhajans, and the tears will come to their eyes. Bhakti.
Wow, Swamiji, thank you really so much for taking this time. You know, I started this project as a, you know, just I kind of wanted to share some people that inspire me, and it's so joyful. You know, I get so much out of these talks. I feel like I get to hang out with you, and we've got your webinars going on YouTube, and so I know you're quite, they're so in-depth, and you've taken us to so many holy places. I'm not all the way caught up, but you've taken us to so many holy places, telling us these amazing stories, and so I know you're busy in your own right, and the fact that you took time to come on here and chat with
me. Rabbi, I want to make it very clear, this is very highfalutin talk, and I'm not there. I'm just repeating what I've heard from my spiritual master. I'm repeating what I heard from the sadhus. I'm an aspiring devotee. I don't think I'm even halfway there yet. But it is a pleasure to repeat the realized knowledge of great sages, because by repeating it over and over and over and practicing the path of bhakti, maybe in this lifetime I'll get one drop of the ocean of bliss and consider my life successful. So thank you for inviting little me on your program. I hope I didn't talk too much.
my
respects again to your Guru Bhai, your Guru Dev, and to all the listeners who have been listening to us. Yeah.
Thank you for tuning in. I sometimes I forget they're there. You know, I feel like we're just on like a Skype combo. Thank you, everybody, for spending time with us. And a very dasya, a very mode of service.
It's the tip of the iceberg. There's much more to discuss.
Yeah, I know, right? It's just like the sampler platter of the nine modes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. Hopefully I'll see you soon, but I will talk to you soon.
Yeah, you can call anytime. We can talk on the all the transcendental subjects.
Yeah, sounds amazing. Right. Thank you so much.
Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.